This program was brought to you by Eat On North. Eat On North is a casual restaurant where honest, uncomplicated food is served without pretension. Find Eat On North at hotelonnorth.com.
I'm Damon Bolte, host of The Speakeasy. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to the main course without Patrick Martins on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I am Alexis McLaughlin here with Philip Gilmore.
Good morning.
We've got in studio Cameroon. Oh, God damn it. How do you say your last name? I'm going to get this wrong every time.
Cameroon Aram.
Aram. Hi. Welcome.
Hi, good morning. My name is pronounced Philip Gilmore. Yes.
I am the worst name pronouncer. God. I was on stage, I was moderating a panel, and no one told me ahead of time that there was a raffle afterwards, and like the panel is ending, they're like, oh, can you call out the winners, pick 10 winners, and everyone had like the worst handwriting and like these crazy names. I'm like, this, everyone, welcome to my worst nightmare.
Wow. How's your week?
My week's been pretty great. It was, you know, Goat-tober still going on, so, a lot of craziness at the office with that. We were really excited. Quincible. Are you guys familiar with Quincible?
Yep.
They do basically, you know, produce boxes. It's like a CSA delivered to your door, but they mix it up and do recipes also. So it's like a CSA meets a Blue Apron. Really well-sourced stuff, but they're supporting Goat-tober this year and put out a Goat-tober box. I think it may be past the deadline to sign up for it, but who knows, maybe they'll have some extra if you ask them nice to try and get one still.
We actually were running for the last couple of days a goat ramen at Moku Moku.
Ooh, I want to try that.
With the goat meatballs and the goat char siu. So it was kind of amazing, yeah.
What
Tell me about MoFad. What's happening with MoFad?
MoFad Lab. So MoFad is moving into their first physical space ever.
What is MoFad?
MoFad, Museum of Food and Drink.
Yes.
So it started by Dave Arnold, who's, you may know,
favorite.
Everyone's favorite, the host of Cooking Issues. And they're starting this, you know, kind of a dual space where it's, you know, part museum, part exhibit, part lab for building creations. And doors will be open October 28th. And you can buy tickets to go see the exhibit.
To the gala?
Yeah, it's going to be a very fancy gala. And it's going to be, the first exhibit is flavor. And so it's going through the history of flavor, synthetic, how it's used. They're going to have like a lot of interactive stuff going on. There's like a pill machine where you like put in the flavor you want and it pops out like a flavor pill for you.
Oh, wow.
Pretty cool stuff. But that's going on, opening October 28th. And I think the exhibit runs till February 28th. But get your tickets early. I know space is really filling up fast. And tickets at tickets.mofad.org.
Awesome.
Yeah. What else is going on in my week? Oh, have you ever been to the Irish, like, hunger monument?
No.
It's really awesome. I stumbled on it last weekend completely by accident. It's, like, by Hudson Park, and I just saw this, like, large, you know,
potato,
kind of like structure. Pretty much.
The potato,
no, it was
famine.
Like it was just a big structure. I saw it from the backside, and you can, you know, like there's a tunnel, so we just went to investigate. And you get past the tunnel and all of a sudden there's this like big, you know, old stone archway, and then indigenous natural like Irish flora and fauna.
Mm-hmm.
And you walk through it, you're transported. It's like being in Ireland, I would imagine, or been to Ireland. But it's what movies look like when you're in Ireland, and it's pretty cool.
Have you been?
Yeah. It was actually, I believe, designed by a colleague of mine who teaches at Parsons, named Brian Toll, I believe.
That may be right. I read all the signs and then quickly forgot them. but I think it was made in 2002, or it's something that's been around for a little while, which always amazes me. It was in great shape, which is something when I studied art in college, we studied this idea of, you know, outdoor sculpture installation and, you know, memorials and monuments. And there's a lot of consideration of, like, is it going to weather well? You may have a great artistic idea, but how's it going to look in 10 years? And
concrete always looks interesting.
Yeah.
In 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years.
Will this statue of this woman holding a torch turn green eventually? What will that look like?
Yeah. I think Statue of Liberty was probably tarnished by the time they put
it over
up.
Here.
Yeah.
Over, bringing it over on the boat. So, Kim Ruse, how are you?
I'm doing all right.
Thank you for coming in.
No problem.
I guess we should say that Kim Ruse is an artist himself.
Kim Ruse is my favorite living painter. I say this, but it's true. I literally,
it's very sweet.
His paintings, actually, when I look at it, it's what's important in painting to me. Like, when I look at his work, I get emotional about how beautiful it is. It's aesthetically very, very pleasing to me. Yes. So, I guess a backstory is Kim Ruse has been a very, very big supporter of my restaurant, Momo Sushi Shack. And over the years, we've kind of forged a friendship. And it's, you know, his love of food obviously is a nice, neat, you know, good foundation for that relationship. But then also, too, my mother actually spent, as a teenager, spent a lot of time in Iran growing up, and then Kim Ruse was actually born there, so we kind of have that in common too. And you were saying you were born in 1958, you said?
Yeah. 1978.
Yeah. So you were right before the Iran-Contra.
Right before the revolution, yeah, which was happening in 78, but was kind of...
Do you think that your birth incited it? That you were this, like, the golden child?
Probably, and,
yeah. Something. So basically, and you moved over from to America when you were 12?
I was 8, actually.
Oh, actually, yeah, 8. Okay, yeah, cool.
1986.
So what do you remember as a
Iran?
Child? Yeah.
You know, it's interesting. I was born in Shiraz, and although we didn't really live there long, we lived mostly in Tehran and in Isfahan. What I remember the most is really Isfahan, because that's where all of my grandparents lived, and I had cousins there, and we spent a lot of time there, and it was...
And that city's known for being, like, just ridiculously beautiful, and monuments, and...
The architecture is really astounding.
Yeah. I was telling him my mom's going to probably go back for the first time next year, and she's so excited about
visiting. What was your mom
that.
Doing in Iran as a young...
My grandfather was basically, like, in the oil industry in the 50s and 60s, and sounds fancier than it is. He was kind of like the boss of the rigs, you know? And they traveled a lot. They lived in Libya, and then my mom went to college in Beirut. So, you know, mostly for, like, her teenage years, she was based in Tehran.
So your grandfather was probably partially responsible for the revolution.
Yeah, in a small way, yes. Yeah.
My grandfather spent time in Iran, too.
Really?
Yeah, background. He never brought the family over, but he was a civil engineer and did sewer systems and pipes, and did a lot of infrastructure. In the 50s and 60s, probably more the 60s.
Interesting. You know, because my great uncle was a civil engineer and was working in that time in Tehran. And did a lot of city planning and that kind of thing.
Sounds like we got to get Grandpa Sal on the phone.
That's really funny.
Yeah.
What if they knew each other?
Yeah, my great uncle was the kind of most educated man in the family. He was he had, like, 5 degrees from Columbia University, which he got in, I want to say, the late 40s, early 50s, something like that. And
you went to Columbia, is it?
I did go to Columbia, actually.
That's, and also you teach there as well?
No, I teach at Parsons.
Teach at Parsons,
yeah. I taught a couple of classes at Columbia, which, you know, they, as an MFA student, when you graduate, they kind of throw you a bone.
Yeah.
Get you started.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. That's nice of them.
So, do you have any memories from before you came over here? Like, what was the climate like there? Like, you know, and before you moved,
I have a lot of memories. I mean, it was quite intense. It was an intense time to be in Iran. Yeah. There was the war with Iraq was a huge part of my childhood. Since I was born in 78, the revolution kind of was normal for me. You know, eventually you hear people telling you stories about what things were like before the revolution. But, you know, I think for me, I just have a lot of memories of school, of playing with my cousins, my grandparents' houses. My mother's parents had a house in Isfahan that was like this really old... when I say mud house, some people who don't have an idea of what Iran is like but might imagine like a mud hut, but I'm talking about like, you know, a large house made from adobe brick with a large courtyard and a large porch. And while my mother would probably hate for me to say this, my grandfather was an opium addict.
Really?
And I remember him sitting on the porch smoking opium all day, and there was an outhouse that was, where you used the bathroom, and he would always kind of walk halfway to the outhouse, and there was a water pump there, and he would stop and, like, have a piss there. Because he didn't have the energy to get to the outhouse. And my grandmother kept chickens, and it was pretty old school. You know,
do you remember the smell of the opium?
Yeah, I do.
Because I personally don't have any experience with it, but I've heard it's like the most amazing, delicious smell in the entire world. But I've never done any drugs. But
it's a sweet smell, and but you know, the coals is what you really smell, because you know.
Oh,
because
he's doing it like the sheesh, the hookah.
It's like the pipe where you stick the hot needle in there to burn the opium.
Wow.
Yeah.
So on the rocks, though.
Yeah, you have like coals, and then you stick the hot needle to heat up, and then there's like a tiny hole, and you stick the needle in the hole
where and the opium just vaporizes. Is.
And what then, is the opium? What form does it come in?
It's almost like a dark, like very sticky? Concentrated molasses. I've heard
dabs now.
It's basically dabs, like wax. Yeah. But yeah, it's exactly like wax, but like in like a sticky hashish. Yeah,
I was never allowed to get too close. Oh, my mother would say, "Stay away from him when he's doing
grandpa,
that."
Yeah.
So it was old school at my grandparents' house, but the other grandparents were, you know, a little bit different. They also had, you know, all the Iranian houses traditionally have a courtyard, a garden, pomegranate trees, persimmon trees.
Yeah.
The kids would get into trouble throwing like really ripe persimmons at each other.
Wow.
In the summertime.
We did that in Florida with grapefruits.
Oh, yeah.
Which is an awful idea, because like a rotting grapefruit explodes and it becomes like a, you know, citric acid bomb in your face. not the friendliest.
I know there's lots of different type of like trees with edible fruits and stuff. Did you have any trees that bore fruit?
And yeah, I mean, you know, the persimmon trees and the pomegranate trees, but the fig trees were my favorite. And just this past summer when I was in Italy, we were in Piemonte, the first time that I had a fig that tasted similar to the figs that I had.
Do you know there's fig trees all over this neighborhood?
Yeah, in Williamsburg and
Do you know, like, the garden space that I showed you, the secret garden?
Yeah, yeah.
There's actually a giant fig tree there.
Is there?
Yeah, we just eat them, the Black Mission figs.
Yeah, a lot of Americans don't know what they are. So, you know, there was pub in Williamsburg, and there was a fig tree outside, and we picked, like, you know, 20 figs, and we took them inside, and the bartender would not taste one, because... They were kind of freaked out. They're like, no, that's okay. They came from the street. They're
it's
beautiful.
It's like what's
figs.
Inside fig Newtons.
Yeah, exactly.
But different.
I think it's. I've always imagined that it's the, the whole area of like Graham and Grand, Graham and Metropolitan. That whole that's all Italian.
Yeah.
And I kind of imagine that. You know, I think that the Italians, you know, probably planted them, and then the birds eat them, and then they, you know, poop the seeds out.
Yeah, a friend, a friend of mine who's an artist who has a house in Williamsburg has a beautiful fig tree, and when he bought the house, they're these old school Italian family, and the guy that died, his family kind of, he went to the funeral, and at the funeral they came to him and said, you know, no matter what you do, just keep that fig tree alive.
Aww.
You
know,
because they had brought, I think they brought it over from Sicily.
Oh, wow.
I have a Sicilian uncle in Queens, and that is like his pride and joy is his fig tree. Every September, I think they're coming into season, like, you know, still in season. But it's just, I mean, they're delicious. Yeah. And New York is a great climate for it. I guess you don't really think about that.
Kind of side note, but it's too interesting not to mention. There's this new thing, and I think they somehow they bury you in like a box, but then there's also a seed in it, and so you actually, the seed grows in your in your rotting body, so the tree grows and represents you.
Yeah.
I always thought it'd be so sad though if, you know, if the tree grew to be like 5 or 6 years old and then the tree died, it would be like having
loss.
Having to like, oh no, he died again, you know,
someone cuts it down,
or somebody somebody murders your spirit tree,
some George Washington
or injures it, you know.
You don't have to do anything with me after I'm gone, you just cremate me, done.
Throw me to the wolves.
Doesn't matter.
So oh, you know, I had a question. I have so many questions I want to ask you that I've never asked you. Did you speak English in Tehran?
No.
So when you came, you moved. When you came over, it was you came straight to California.
No. Actually, we went to Ohio first.
Ohio. That's right. I remember that. Yeah. Where in Ohio?
Cincinnati.
Did you get a warm welcome?
Oh, yeah.
In Ohio?
Yeah.
The first rule he learned, whatever you do, don't tell anybody you're from Iran in the 80s.
No, it was rough. It was rough. But, you know, we lived with my aunt and uncle and their three children for about a year. And that was a really intense and beautiful time. So
probably because you probably sharing like not a giant mansion, probably
they had a large house, but it was intense. I mean, it was, you know, suddenly you have you know, two sets of parents and five kids.
I have an older like brother. Communal living, basically.
And they're to this day they're kind of like, you know, siblings to me, and my aunts and uncle,
yeah,
you know, they're very important people to me.
That's amazing,
because they're, you know, without them, we wouldn't have been able to really settle down in the U.S. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as difficult as school was and as difficult as the climate was in Ohio, both literally and figuratively, you know, it was great to have that family support there.
Yeah.
So when you move from Iran to Ohio, you move in with your aunt and uncle. Do you share the same family meals that you remembered in Iran? Did you have access to, you know, the same kinds of foods and...
Yeah.
You know, traditions.
Sometimes absolutely.
My family moved from New York to Florida, and like they couldn't find arugula.
Yeah,
or good bread, and right. All of a sudden, like their culture just got slashed in half.
Yeah, you find ways. You know, you find substitutes for certain ingredients, but Iranians, as I'm sure many people are, notorious for bringing stuff from Iran. So, you know,
in bulk,
like, you know, you have a suitcase and it has your clothes and whatever, and then it has like, you know, a ridiculous amount of saffron, some fenugreek, which is a, you know, these, and then these sun-dried limes that are like kind of like brown on the outside and black on the inside.
They're very hard to find here, I guess.
Yeah.
Impossible.
Well, not anymore though, because you know, the Iranian community in California has really thrived on, you know, creating these markets, and
there's only like a million, I think, in California, right?
Yeah, there are a lot, and so
it's hundreds of thousands, definitely,
right?
Yeah, in LA.
And when people say, you know, where can I find the best Iranian restaurant in New York, I say, in Los Angeles.
I'm pretty, you know, eyeballs deep in restaurants right now. But if I ever do another restaurant, I want to do a Persian restaurant. It's such amazing food.
Yeah,
you know, it's yeah. We've talked about this before, but for those of you that have not had Persian food, it's kind of you know, if you know, Palestinian and Israeli food, kind of the same. Turkish food, Greek food, you know, very similar. Armenian food, but like Iranian food is just so unto itself. It's so, of course it gets, there's things that they share, but it's really like just its own game, in my opinion.
Yeah. If there's something that Iranians love to brag about is our, 7,000 years of history and the 7,000 years that we've been making art and the 7,000 years that we've been cooking. So, it's that kind of like cultural nostalgia is funny to me, and it gets on my nerves sometimes, but but it's kind of true.
Yeah, I think me and my friend looked at a map and we're like, how many people claim that they invented dolmas? Armenians, we invented dolma. The Turks, the Greek.
Is there any a good example of a food that is really uniquely Iranian that no one else in the region claims to make?
A million things, right?
Yeah, basically. I mean, there are many. I think for, my favorite food growing up, and in fact, I've just been invited to contribute to a book of artists and writers' recipe book, which is some are kind of like surreal recipes that are not really, and some are more poetic recipes that don't really result in food that you can eat. But I give a recipe for qorma sabzi, which is my favorite kind of Iranian food growing up, and my mother made it very well. So it's a stew of made from herbs and usually lamb, with the sun-dried limes and the fenugreek as the kind of really distinct aroma. And I like to make it with lamb shanks as well as stew meat. So it really gets kind of rich and flavorful, and you stew it for a really long time. And
is there a version of that that it can be with or without meat too? Could it be without?
I mean, traditionally it's not without meat, but you can make, like, I have friends that make it with mushrooms just to, as a
vegetarian
kind of contemporary
thing.
Yeah, Philip, if you want to eschew 7,000 years of tradition, go for it.
I think it's pretty traditional to do tofu in it.
Yeah. No, but you can do it with mushrooms because it does have beans and it also has protein.
Mm-hmm.
It's super labor intensive, and this is like the food of a very kind of a culture that's entrenched in gender roles.
Mm-hmm.
So, the women stay at home and look after the kids and cook all day, and, they're chopping the herbs all day, and then they're drying the herbs, and then they're sauteing the herbs, and then they're, then you stew it for 3 or 4 hours, And so it's like a very old school. But now they have, in any supermarket in Iran or in Los Angeles, you can go and get the frozen herbs that, so half the work's already done. That in the pressure cooker with the meat, and you're cutting down like a 6-hour job to like an hour, maybe 45 minutes.
Wow. Yeah.
Within a culture with strict gender roles, you sound like you know how to cook, but is that common for, guys to learn how to cook?
Absolutely. That somewhat, I mean, that's like, only part true. But there are similar kind of stereotypes as there are in the West, which is like the men like to grill the kebabs.
I was just gonna say, is there a version of the dad barbecuing on Sunday in Iran, kind of thing?
Totally. Yeah. But no, it's like also a macho thing to cook, I think. I love to cook, but not for the macho purposes. I'm not very macho. But
I think it's very macho that you're not macho. How about that?
Yeah, thank you. Yeah. Is that good? Is macho good? Should I want to be macho?
I get confused by that.
I think it's waning in popularity. Yeah. I think the macho thing is fading out with the bro thing. It's like, if you're sensitive.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, be sweet. Let's take a quick break, and then we'll be back to talk more Persian food with Kamaruz.
Yeah.
Hi, I'm Brian Alberg, and I'm the executive chef at Eat On North in the Berkshires of Western Massachusetts. Eat On North in the Berkshires of Western Massachusetts is a casual restaurant where good, honest, uncomplicated food is served to our guests. Our restaurant is part of a hotel called Hotel On North, the newly opened boutique hotel in downtown Pittsfield. We source local ingredients from our neighboring farms and offer an all-day dining menu of flavorful American cuisine for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and on weekends we serve brunch. Our oyster bar serves up delicious shellfish and oyster samplers until 11 p.m. Check out our menu at eatonnorth.com and follow us on Instagram.
Hi, and we're back with the main course. Today's guest is artist Kamaruz Aram. I'm sorry. I'm just like, names kill me every time.
Yeah, it's okay.
It's all right.
We're talking about Iranian food. Where do you want to go from here, Phil?
I was going to say, so you're an artist.
Yeah.
You like to doodle and paint and stuff. when you were in Iran, were you already drawing? Like, there's some artists that I talk to, and then, like, you know, from the time they were 2 years old, they were like, you know, as fast as the paper comes, they were drawing. Like, did you always have an aptitude for?
Not at all. I mean, I like to joke with students sometimes that, you know, there are the artists that are born, and as soon as they're born, they turn around and draw a portrait of their mother, you mm-hmm. know? Like, I never had that ability to draw like that. For me, we were talking about, you know, the notion of macho-ness. I was always the sensitive kid, you know, and I was very melancholic, and, you know, I wrote a lot. I drew a little bit. I was into music. I played music for a while. I got almost serious about being a drummer at one point.
Wow.
I was pretty good, and I could have been very good, but I kind of let it fizzle when I went to art school. Mm. So it was never a matter of, like, being able to draw really well, but it was just kind of something that was part of the big picture for me.
Yeah.
And I don't think it's unrelated, actually, to my mother's ability to cook, because she's a very intuitive cook, and I think the way that she approaches food is quite poetic, mm-hmm. Even if she doesn't see it that way. Her sensitivity,
natural.
Yeah, her sensitivity to flavors and aromas is really unique, I think. And, you know, just knowing what something needs, whether mm-hmm. it's visual or whether it's something that one eats, or whether it's you know, music. I think it's having a sensibility for that, or having a sensitivity to that.
Well, that's not to talk about you in the third person, but what I like about your work so much is I've never really, like, put it this way in my mind, but it's almost like if I'm eating a dish, it has to have the right amount of salt. It has to have the right amount of acid. It has to have some sort of textural crunch or bite to it, you know, and also acid, lime, vinegar, and there's a balance. And that's what it's also like a good painting. It's like, what could I add to this painting that would make it better? And that's what I like about your work, is I look at it and it's like, it's a complete thing, you know? So there's nothing lacking in your work. And that's what I like about your paintings. I hope that's what you think about my food.
Absolutely.
That's a neat comparison. It's like, you know, that's, yeah. I guess it's with anything, you know, if it's perfect, if there's nothing lacking.
Yeah.
So.
It's such a challenge, you know, with contemporary art. There's so much of, people that kind of perceive the avant-garde as something that challenges those notions of, like, resolution.
Mm-hmm.
But in a way, it's like, in the end, even if you're kind of stripping it down to its bare kind of minimum ingredients, I'm talking about a painting at this point, for example, there's still, you know, I think people still strive for that kind of balance. We used to say with a friend of mine in college that the painting needs to hum. You know, mm-hmm. when the painting starts to hum, that's when you kind of stop.
Yeah. That's interesting. At Hi Hello, one of the dishes that we get the most compliments on is the Eggs Benedict, and it's really an English muffin, good smoked salmon, perfectly poached egg, hollandaise sauce, and a little paprika. That's it. And it's so ironic that people give so many compliments to it, because it's actually just exactly what it's supposed to be. And people, I think sometimes people if it's Eggs Benedict is Eggs Benedict because it hums perfectly the way it is. You don't need to add anything to it.
Right.
And so it's ironic that, you know, that they get so many compliments on this thing that's just a classic simple thing.
Right.
Yeah. If it hums, don't fuck with it.
Yeah.
Where are we trending in food right now? You know, as far as like how elaborate a dish is.
I don't think that molecular gastronomy has peaked per se, but I think that like it got so crazy, you know, 6 years ago, that I think that really, like, you know, I think people, even at the highest levels of cuisine, it's really about simplicity. Like, for example, I watched what's it called, A Chef's Table on Netflix, the one about Dan Barber. There was a couple of things that was on that show that I literally almost teared up, because it was so, like, just flawless. Like, just, you know, like we're talking about a painting, just like absolutely. And I'm not even there eating this thing, but one of the dishes that he does is just like really simple, like, you know, some sort of farmer bread. And then there's a dish with three different butters. And so each of the butters comes from a different cow, same breed, same diet, but each butter is literally a different, you know, one, this butter was made from one cow, this butter, so you can actually taste it. That, like, that's perfection.
Yeah.
That is the simplest thing, and it's so perfect, you know?
Yeah.
And then, so.
It's almost cliche at this point to talk about Italian food as, you know, the cuisine that really requires the bare minimum, just keep it simple.
Yeah.
But, I mean, one of my favorite foods is Italian food, and I was in northern Italy this summer, and most of what I ate was, you know, just, and it is like, Iranian food to an extent, where it's like, you know, the ingredients really have to be respected and introduced in a subtle manner, so that, you know, when using a truffle, for example, you know, it's like, how do you do that without just being showy, you know?
Yeah.
Because there are these, you hear about these extravagant dinners where each guest has a truffle to shave on their food as on any food, and, you know, you don't put truffle on any food. You know, it doesn't work that way. So
using ingredients with restraint.
Yeah. Which is something I think about a lot in painting, actually.
Yeah.
You know, the idea of restraint and not overpainting and
when is that next brushstroke too many?
Yeah.
Like the brushstroke that broke the donkey's back.
And when you go over, then there's a lot more work to kind of try to get it back. Yeah. You know?
But what about can you remember when you're 8 years old, you basically have eaten Persian food for your whole life at this point, and then you're living with your aunt and uncle, and you're probably still eating Persian food.
Yeah.
Do you have any, like, you know, like, first memories? Like, I don't remember the first time I had a grilled cheese. I don't remember the first time I had a hamburger. I don't remember the first time I had... But do you have any, like, specific memories of, like an iconic American food that you ate when you were 9 or 10 years old, or even 14 years old, and that you try it, and you're like, oh, my God, this is heaven, or, oh, my God, what do these fucking people eat here?
Yeah, Well, there's a lot of that, actually. A lot of mixed emotions about being introduced to American food in the Midwest in the 1980s.
Yeah.
You know? So
you sleep over at a friend's house, and they pull a paper bowl out of the microwave and be like, here's dinner. And you're like,
yeah. I did have a couple of experiences like that, which, you know, I couldn't eat that food. I just could not. And to this day,
what specifically?
Just like anything that comes out of the microwave, that goes from the freezer into the microwave.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just really difficult for me. It makes me, you know. And the thing that my school, like eating at the school cafeteria.
Oh, was, no.
the strange thing was that was like really desirable for a while.
Yeah.
Because the use of cheese in American food was like very, you know, like making, we never made grilled cheese with the, you know, the butter. And we made it like, you know, just like a cheese toast. Like you take a piece of bread, put some cheddar cheese on it, stick it, or a slice of American, and stick it in the toaster oven, right? And then I'd put a little bit of ketchup on it. There are some interesting things about Iranian food that most people don't know. That might be an interesting time to introduce. Because, for example, we have something called macaroni, which basically is like macaroni.
Yeah.
But you make spaghetti and you kind of... Have you had tadig? You know, the when you make the Iranian rice and you let it cook in the pot and the bottom of it becomes crispy with potatoes and a little saffron and yeah.
So it's just like specifically the crispy rice at the bottom of the bowl?
Yeah, so that's tadig.
It's like super, it's like borderline. I mean, if you don't do it right, it burns, but it's like right on the edge of right before it burns.
And you get the perfect rice and then you put the tadig on the side and everybody fights over the last piece and... but with the spaghetti, they'll make spaghetti with a meat sauce and do the same thing with it, where the bottom gets crispy. And then when it's served, a lot of Iranians will put ketchup on top of that. There's
really?
Already tomato sauce in it, so, you know. But,
amazing.
Or people who put, you know, when you go to the pizza place, the fast food pizza place in Tehran, there's often, like, ketchup as a topping, you know.
Wow.
So there's, like, these weird things that have been kind of, I don't know how they... But, you know, you ask about my childhood memories of American food. I'll never forget the smell and taste of an Iranian pizza parlor... where you get your Coke in the glass bottle, Coke. I should put in air quotes. I don't know.
Yeah.
You know, you know. And I think it was Coke sometimes.
Yeah.
And you have the kind of wax paper straw.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just like that. The feeling of, you know, drinking that through the wax paper straw is so unique and that's a distinct memory for me.
Yeah.
Can we, I don't mean to interrupt, but can we circle back to this ketchup thing? Because I feel like we skimmed over that and we need to go in a little bit deeper. Is that a result of an Iranian traveling to the U.S. and then being like, I found the ingredient and packing that suitcase full of ketchup?
You know what? I have to tell you this story before, because I know the answer to this.
Do you?
Yes. Okay. So I'm obsessed with this. Do you know the hot sauce that's called Crystal?
Yeah.
Do you know Crystal sauce? It's literally, you can get a big bottle for 99 cents, and it's kind of like the kind of like lowbrow version of Tabasco, and it's from Louisiana, and there is literally a cult following in Saudi Arabia, and reason being, well, it's a joke. Like, they'll even have like little bottles they'll carry, and it's like, you know, I always take a bottle of Crystal if I'm going to eat at my mother-in-law's house, because he, you know, no matter how bad the food is, I can always put Crystal sauce on it. So there's this cult following, and it's because all of the oil rig workers, like my grandfather, who's also spent a lot of time in Louisiana, brought over, you know, cases of Crystal sauce to Saudi Arabia when they were working on it. So it might be as simple as, you know, the people that were the civil engineers and maybe bringing ketchup over? Is that possible?
No idea. No,
you were just possible. You were saying when your family came here, you packed the suitcase full of like saffron and everything else. Yeah. I'm thinking like your uncle, after he's done studying at Columbia, packs the suitcase full of ketchup. And like, I found gold.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Bring it home.
Yeah.
Ketchup on pizza.
Ketchup on pizza.
All right. We can go to more highbrow topics. I just had to pause on that one for a moment.
I love hot sauce on pizza, so I guess ketchup is good on everything.
Yeah.
I treat my eggs as a vehicle for ketchup.
So when did you move to California? Or did
I never lived in California?
Oh, I always thought you did, but your parents live in California.
My parents live in California now.
So where did you spend all your entire childhood in Ohio?
Yeah, from 8 till 19.
Okay,
and then I went to college in Baltimore, and then I moved to New York for grad school, and I stayed since arrived in June or July of 2001.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah,
you've been in New York since 2001.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, and so. So, tell me about your first art show.
Yeah. You know, the interesting thing is I started quite young, and I was never a career-driven artist because I never thought that that was a possibility.
Mm-hmm.
I went to grad school because I wanted to study with an artist called Kara Walker, as well as several other artists, but Kara was the kind of main draw for me. And I applied for a government grant, and I applied to one program, and that was Columbia. And I got the government grant, and it's the only way I could have afforded to go to Columbia, you know. Mm-hmm. So I got the grant before I was admitted to Columbia, so I got nervous for a moment. But then I went there, and it sounds so kind of fortuitous and so lucky in a way, because I just I never planned on having a career. Even while I was at grad school, I would talk to other students. I was very young and naive. I went straight from undergrad, you know. And I would talk to other students, and I'd say, so is your goal to kind of, like, you know, show at galleries and, you know, make a living off of this? Do you think that's possible? And they would say, they would also kind of say, yeah, of course, like, what's yours? And I would say, I don't know. I don't know. I didn't know that was possible, you know. And in that first year out of grad school, I met a gallerist who offered me my first show. It was a small gallery called Oliver Cam. It was Oliver Cam 5BE Gallery. He started in his apartment, which was apartment 5BE, and then grew into like a space in Chelsea. First a second floor space, then a ground floor space. He showed a lot of really great artists. And one of the gallerists who had a really kind of wide view of what the possibilities are for contemporary art. He wasn't limited in a particular kind of art, and he wasn't kind of like a too cool for school, you know. He was just all over the place.
And what year was this?
That was in 2004, was my first show. And it went better than I could have expected. I sold the work, and it was reviewed in the Times by Holland Cotter, who's one of my favorite New York Times critics. Favorite
of course he is.
Well, he really is. You know, I mean, everything that he writes, I think, is so thoughtful, and he kind of goes to the parts of the so-called art world that most critics don't.
Yeah.
So I think he's really important.
Wow.
That's awesome. That's a great start. I just want to say thank you so much for coming on the show today. It was a pleasure having you. If people want to find out a little bit more about you or your work, is there somewhere they can go to see that?
Yeah, they can go to my website, which is just kamrooz.aram.com, KAMROOZARAM.
Cool. And we can be sure to put a link to that in today's episode. Yeah, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you so much for coming in.
Yeah, happy Sunday, guys.
Happy Sunday.